the privilege of hearing you. I might have the first year I was sober. I don't remember too much about that year. It looks a little familiar. He's been sober 25 years, I think you said, so I haven't served him a drink. So I must know him from an AA meeting. Cliff?
Morning. My name is Cliff Walker, and I'm a sleepy alcoholic. If anybody wants to go to sleep during this talk, go ahead. And I may join you. I know Bill will go to sleep. He came with me so I can give him hell on the way back.
You know,
of all the days in the week for me to be spiritual,
Sunday's always been the worst.
And I'll explain a little more about that later. And particularly in this very beautiful but sin-loving town, and I love sin. This is quite a challenge for me, but I'm going to try to be spiritual. First, I'd like to thank Les and Marge and the General Service Committee for inviting Dorothy and I here to your first roundup.
It's been a wonderful experience,
and Les, I'm quite sure it won't be your last roundup, because everything has gone, for a first one, Jesus,
it's been remarkable. Just, you know, you talk about making mistakes. Well, that's what you're supposed to do in AA. You know, from the very first, AA has been experimental. So you make your mistakes, and you learn from them, and you correct them. That's the way AA grew and prospered. So if you didn't make any mistakes, it just wouldn't be AA. But it's been wonderful, and I'm delighted to be here. You know, I used to be quite contemptuous of conferences and conventions, and I'd read about them in the grapevine, and the one time I was invited to one in Arizona, and I became a conference convert, because now I go to everyone that I can. But you know, one of the things that conferences to me, or a convention or a roundup, is a 12-step call in mass. You know, you get a new guy, a new baby, and you tell them about all our numbers. Oh, 500,000 of us are now sober throughout the world. But that's just words. But you bring him to one of these things, and he sees all these sober drunks. It's worth 1,000 words just to see this example. Testimony is right. I mean, AA is not theoretical. It's evidential. You know, somewhere in the Bible, I'm a preacher's son, so I used to know the Bible. In one of the stories, it tells about Peter and Paul, the apostles, who cure an incurable lame man. And the ecclesiastics of the day, I guess they're the eggheads, the smart people, happened to see it. And they asked these apostles, well, how come? How'd you do this? And they said, well, this was the name of Christ. Well, what could the eggheads say? They could quarrel with a theory, but they couldn't quarrel with the experience. There was evidence, testimony that it worked. Can anybody quarrel with this? There's a lot of evidence that this thing works. We not only have a program of recovery, we have this group, our society, which is an overwhelming amount of testimony that this thing works. But there's another thing about a conference that I think is equally important. And that's why I like the theme of the roundup. Sober fun in the sun. You know, to show a newcomer that we can stay sober and have fun too is quite a thing. You couldn't have made me believe this years ago. Not by any means. I mean, fun and joy and laughter are very important. In fact, the master taught there are two ways a person could waste their life. One was to shirk responsibility, run away from it, and not desert their obligations to people. That was an affront against God. But he said there's another way, just as bad, and that was to give no pleasure and have none. But people should laugh and sing. And I think probably one of the most scathing passages in all the history of literature was Christ's denunciation of the cheerless, gloomy, self-righteous Pharisees. When he very bluntly told them, God is a happy God and he wants his children to be happy. That life is a gift to be enjoyed and not a penance to be served. And certainly, isn't that something we find here? Unrestrained joy and laughter. I think a good belly laugh is just as spiritual as the Lord's Prayer. And I wish I had that talent that Dick and Ed and Red and Maury. I mean, to make people laugh. God, every time I tell a joke, nobody laughs. And Dorothy says, quit telling them, so I have. But I'd just love to be able to do it, but I can't. So don't expect me to be funny. Yeah, I went to a meeting down in Anaheim once, and before the meeting, a woman says, you're the speaker? I said, yeah. She says, are you funny? I said, well, not intentionally. But she says, well, I'm going to the Al-Anon meeting. So she did. You know, a lot of people say, well, spiritual meeting, they sit on the program. Well, I thought every AA meeting is spiritual. And it is, I agree. But I think it's a proper and right thing to do is to name one of our meetings spiritual. Because we are paying tribute to and giving credit to the source of our sobriety. And all that goes with it, God as we understand it. And from the very beginning, AA has been spiritual. And the first link in the chain of events that created this society, that started in 1933 in Switzerland, when Carl Jung, the great Swiss psychiatrist, told a New York businessman, whom he had been treating a year for his drinking, that he couldn't help it. That the alcoholic neurosis was so deep that medical science or psychiatry had no answer. And the New York businessman said, well, does that mean that you're condemning me to die? Don't people like me ever get well? And Carl Jung says, well, on very rare occasions, drinkers of your type do get well, by spiritual conversion. And the New York businessman says, well, I believe in God. I go to church. I have faith. And Carl Jung said, well, that isn't enough. This must be a vital living thing, a working thing. The kind of an experience that will change you, give you an entirely different set of attitudes and sense of values. Well, the New York businessman went back to New York and he joined the Oxford movement, from which a lot of our principles come from, which was a spiritually centered group of men and women who helped each other. Some were religionists, some not. And this New York businessman had such a vital experience and he got well. He passed this on to another drunk called Ebby, and Ebby got well. Ebby passed it on to another drunk called Bill, our first member.
And Bill passed it on to Dr. Bob. And he got well. Which set up this chain reaction of one drunk talking to another that has now spanned the world. But always, the essence has been spiritual. I mean, sooner or later, every AA member comes to believe in and make use of a power greater than himself. Now, those that don't take this very, very important step of faith seldom, if ever, get permanently well. That means that God, as we understand it, is the very firm foundation upon which this society rests. However, how many times through the years I have seen some wonderful, charming men and women turn away and die because they just couldn't accept it. They made a big hurdle out of something that shouldn't have been there at all. Do you know, in the early days of, in Los Angeles, when we were very young, and I was very young in AA, we had some of our people that splintered off from our group. They were atheists and agnostics. And they called themselves the Wagoneers. And they took all the spiritual stuff out of the book. I mean, out of the program. And they published their own book called the Alcoholergics. And you know that they grew at first faster than we did. That scared the hell out of us. We didn't have many people. But you know, through the years, these Wagoneers, to a man, are either dead, mad, or have come back to the fold. So this must be important. This morning, on this spiritual meeting, I would like to share with you a chapter out of my own AA life of recovery. And it's too frantic, painful years of my first 2 years in AA where it took me that period to come to believe. And you know, I'll say right here, I thank God that the founders or whoever wrote the book, Bill, didn't put a time limit on coming to believe, or else I wouldn't have been here. And I think a lot of us wouldn't. Now, this is a part of my life for a long time I didn't share at all in AA because I was kind of embarrassed about it or ashamed, I guess. And I spoke with apology, but not that anymore. But one time at the Whittier group, it was brought very forcibly home to me that this is a part of my life I should share. I went to the meeting one night at Whittier, my home group. Before the meeting, a guy came up to me and he says, Cliff, you've been around quite a long time and I want to ask you something. I got a problem. He said, I joined AA about a month ago, and I was a terrible alcoholic. And he said, I just love this thing you have here. I love you people. It's the most remarkable thing I've ever seen, the camaraderie and the interest that you take in each other. And I want to be in AA a sober AA more than anything in the world. The last week, I bought the big book, and I've been reading it and studying it, and it's wonderful. However, Cliff, I'm intelligent enough to know that the crux of this thing is coming to believe in a divinity. He said, Cliff, I'd like to do that. I'd just love to believe. But I know I can't. He says, my folks were hard-shell Baptists. And they taught me to hate and fear God. And I know I can never come to take that step. He said, Cliff, now, give it to me straight. Am I going to be one of the 25% that you talk about that can never make this program? Well, the meeting was called to order. Whittier being my home group, and me being an old-timer, I'm not allowed to talk. Which is good. I mean, I go along with it. But this particular night, the leader got up and said the speakers hadn't showed up. He says, there's an old-timer sitting out there. Maybe he'd like to say something. I'll tell you, boy, I just dashed up to that podium. I ran up there because I had something to say. And I told this newfound friend he had nothing to worry about, not a darn thing. In fact, he was telling my story before the meeting. And I told him how I had been a preacher's son back in a small town in Kansas. And in those days, boy, I'll tell you, hell, fire, and brimstone was the order of the day. If you didn't preach that, you weren't kept as a minister. And I loved my father, but I hated his religion. And I hated his God. I hated to be the example for all these other little boys. Everything they told me that was sinful, God was the things I liked to do. And the worst day in the week was Sunday. God, how I hated Sunday. That was God and Jesus' day. And I go to Sunday school. Some hard-faced old gal would say, you gotta love God and Jesus. How could I love God? He's the guy that punished me when I did the things that were fun. I mean, I'm a little boy, and I make mistakes too, you know. He didn't seem to understand that. And Jesus, how could I love Jesus? You know, in those days, they had a picture of Jesus on the Sunday school wall. Red-headed man with a red beard. Sad-eyed. Sad-faced. No muscle. You know, little boys, you admire strength. Sure, I could admire Daniel, who slew the lions, or David, who slew the giant, but not Jesus. And this little boy grew up to be contemptuous of the greatest man the world has ever known. The man who changed the world with just 12 illiterate men. Has done more to change the world than all the armies and all the dictators of all time. But here this little boy is contemptuous. And God, this hatred and fear of God continued. Until in 1940, I come face to face with the same thing that my newfound friend had come to. That God is or God isn't. And here was a guy who was in the last stages of chronic alcoholism. I had known so much of madness. Countless jobs I had lost. All my hopes and dreams that I to be successful had been shattered. I had reached the dilemma that all alcoholics sooner or later reach. With this all-powerful obsession to drink, guaranteed that I drink, that I always take another drink. This increasing physical sensitivity and allergy that I had guaranteed that I'd die or go mad if I do drink. Dorothy, thank God, though, and I want to say for the Al-Anons, I just couldn't say enough for them. If it wasn't for Dorothy, my God, I wouldn't have had a chance to even be here. Because Dorothy in 1938 and 1939 knew that I was sick. And you know, in those days, alcoholism wasn't a very popular sickness. You never had all these wine and roses pictures and you know, articles about the poor sick alcoholic. We were just drunken SOBs, weak well and spineless. I think they used to call me a drunkard. God, that's a horrible. But Dorothy knew I was sick. How she knew it, I don't know. One time I asked Dorothy, after I had sobered up, I said, honey, how did you know I was sick? Why didn't you leave me like any respectable woman would? She said, well, Cliff, she said, when you were sober, you were such a fine person, a good husband, a good father. Then you'd go on these terrible, savage binges, and you'd change so. But one time, she said, after you were coming out of one and you were becoming lucid, you broke down and cried. First time I'd ever seen you cry when you were sober. And I knew that you were in the grip of something that you just couldn't do anything about. And I determined I would find a way out. And God, we tried a lot of things. Everything that we knew then. I even tried Think and Grow Rich. You know, it's a pretty good book. I guess to get rich with, but it isn't worth a damn for staying sober. It worked for a while. I used the same philosophy instead of getting rich on staying sober, and I stayed sober a while. But like everything else, it ended in failure. So, Dorothy found AA for me in early 1940. And I went to those first meetings up at the Cecil Hotel. And Mort, my first sponsor, who had never been to an AA meeting, started this meeting by reading the 12 steps because he didn't know what else to do. But I think he was wiser than he knew, because he was saying to future alcoholics, this is not a thing of personalities, it's a thing of principles. I know nothing about it. If you want the answers, they're in the book. Anyway, he reads these 12 steps every meeting. And you know, I got quite disturbed about it. So I asked Mort once, I said, why do you read these damn steps every meeting? He said, why not? I said, well, they're repetitious. I said, once you've heard them, you've heard them. Also, I think they're goddamn obnoxious. I don't like them. He says, well, why not? Well, I says, well, they're not pertinent to my problem. Well, he says, what is your problem? I just drink too much. Otherwise, when I'm sober, I'm a nice guy. Dorothy used to tell me that. She said, gee, I can't understand it. When you're sober, you're nice, but when you get drunk, you're terrible. She used to have a pet name for me in those days. In my cups, she used to call me a revolving bastard. I'd say, when I was sober, I says, why a revolving one? She said, well, any angle I look at you from, you're still a bastard. And I could give you 35,000 reasons why she should call me that, but I haven't got the time. Anyway, Mort, of course, he was bright. Hell, he'd only been sober 2 or 3 months. But, you know, one thing in AA, when you ask for advice, you always get it. You know, most of us can give advice by the gallon and take it by the thimbleful. I am one of those kind. Some guy after the meeting, you know, he come up to me and says, Cliff, you don't have to take all 12 of those steps. Just take one step that you like, and that'll keep you sober. I like that. But being a gambler, by nature, I'm in the wrong place up here, I guess. I always like the percentages on my side, so I said, well, I'll take 2 steps, the first and the last. So I became an AA two-stepper. And I stayed sober for a while, but that wasn't unusual at all. I'd got to the point where I had to stay sober for a while. But I blamed it on those two steps. But I finally got taken drunk. And I went on the greatest binge of my entire career. The most savage, the most destructive, the most demoralizing binge of all. And I got so bad that the AAs of that day and age would have nothing to do with me. And brother, you had to be bad. You know, we couldn't afford to lose members in those days. So we had a goon squad. Anybody get drunk, the goon squad would go get him. Guy might be in the bar enjoying himself, but he got pulled out of the bar, taken home, and sat on till he was sober. Whether he wanted to be sober or not. But even they gave up on it. It was terribly demoralizing because Dorothy and I had put up such fond hopes for this AA business. We thought that probably it was our last resort. Another thing that made it worse, at least for me, at my first AA meeting, I had met a guy named Gordon who'd come all the way from Phoenix, Arizona with his wife to find AA. But before he went to the meeting, he made what I think is quite a logical mistake. He told Myrtle, he says, "Myrtle, you know, if I'm going to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I guess I better get drunk before I go. Or else, how are they going to know I'm an alcoholic?" Well, he got drunk, but he overdid it. He passed out at his first meeting. He slept all through the whole meeting. And Dorothy and I, but the next Friday night he came back sober, and he stayed sober. Then they went back to Phoenix. And we had got to know them pretty well before they left. Anyway, right in the midst of this binge, Dorothy begins to get these wonderful letters from Myrtle about Gordon. To me, they were terrible. They were saying how well Gordon was doing. He was staying sober. The kids weren't scared of him anymore. The neighbors were speaking to him. He had changed. He was staying sober. Well, you can imagine these letters, the impact on the Walker household, which was in shambles. Here I'm on the worst binge of all. Well, I don't know, I got kind of an obsessive type of personality. I get fixed ideas and they grow. Anyway, and at that time I was holding on very precariously to a milkman's job. But I got thinking about Gordon staying sober over in Phoenix. They didn't even have an AA group over there. I had one over here and I was staying drunk. Max said, "Well, this is the way my thinking going." I says, "That little guy didn't even have the decency to go to his first meeting sober." I did. He was a little skinny, scrawny guy. He wore glasses. I didn't. I knew I was smarter, better looking, stronger and everything. Now he stands sober. I couldn't get over it. Well, the inevitable happened. I disappeared. The milk truck disappeared. The money disappeared. And you know where we all wound up. Phoenix, Arizona. And from a Phoenix bar, the dirtiest, drunkenest, stinkingest milkman you ever saw, called Gordon. Gordon come down and got me. Took me home. I started to say, he cleaned me up, but he couldn't have got me clean, but he did get me sober. Am I too close to the mic, Red? Huh? Oh, yeah. Yes. That's feedback. How am I doing? Better? Oh, okay. I didn't know that. I'm sorry. I have a whiskey tenor voice that don't go very far out without help. Anyway, Gordon finally got me lucid and fairly sober. So when he did, I got him in a corner and I popped the $64,000 question. I looked this little skinny, scrawny guy in the eye and I said, Gordon, what keeps you sober? This little skinny, scrawny guy looked me in the eye and he says, Cliff, you ain't gonna like it, but I'm gonna give it to you straight. I am staying sober because I have placed my drinking problem in the hands of a power greater than myself that I call God. And I use this power for direction in everything I do, by working the steps and increasing my contact with it. And my whole life has changed. I said, Gordon, do you mean to say that I have driven 500 miles on a milk truck to get this old God business again? It just won't work. I was the most bitterly disappointed man in the United States. He couldn't have given me a more unacceptable answer. He didn't argue. That night he put me on one of those great, huge freight trucks that ply goods from Phoenix to Los Angeles. Somewhere between Los Angeles and Phoenix, in the dead of night, this guy, for the first time in his life, hit bottom. New people will ask, well, what do you mean, hitting bottom? Well, you'll hear it quite often in AA, and it's kind of hard. I can't really tell you what it is. I think it's different things for different people. I know one thing, you modern AAs have lifted the bottom that drunks have to hit to get sober. I know that some people have high thresholds of pain and low bottoms, and some have low thresholds of pains and high bottoms. I think the person knows when they hit it. But to me, it was like somebody had turned the light on inside me, and I saw Cliff Walker as he really was. I saw my drinking in all its sordidness, stripped of all the things I'd attached to it. You know, I used to think it was a manly thing to do, to drink. Sure, I went to SC during prohibition days, and everybody carried a flask. And the guy who couldn't hold his liquor was a sissy. The old silent movies used to, you know, the manly guy, the westerner, the fast gun, draw guy, was always, he could outdrink anybody in the house. But all these things were stripped away, and I saw my drinking for what it was. I saw that I was not only destroying my own life, but the lives of my two boys and Dorothy. And you know, all of a sudden I realized that I had become a complete and total failure at the business of living. I couldn't possibly tell you how deep my depression was, my despair and loneliness. I very close threw myself out on the speeding highway. Then I thought, my God, suicidal. My boys and Dorothy will think I'm a coward. That's a coward's way out. Surely there's a way out for me. I thought, well, Gordon here staying sober in Phoenix, and Frank and Mort over in Los Angeles, maybe there is a chance. See, I'd run out of choices, only alternatives. To keep on drinking, I knew, was mean madness and oblivion. The other way, maybe a possible chance. And that was the moment that I made the decision that became the turning point in my life. And it was simply this. I would come back to Los Angeles and come back to AA if they would have me and do anything in the world they asked me to do, whether I liked it or not. You see, I had reached the attitude of mind of any person who is terminally sick, who knows they're going to die. There's nobody so open-minded as a dying, is there? Now, you know, a strange thing, through the years, I've heard psychiatrists call what happened to me deflation in death. And then religionists call it surrender. And I think they're all one and the same. Hitting bottom, ego reduction, surrender. But according to them, this is the time your spiritual awakening starts. I would have never bought that then, no. But I came back to Los Angeles, and they took me back. That's the time my tough sponsor took over. We talk a great deal of sponsorship and responsibility. I, for one, believe in sponsors. Everybody should pick their own. I had two, Mort and Frank. But Frank was my tough sponsor, and he took over. He was I wish you could have met. He was wise beyond his AA years. He had a sense of propriety that I've never seen in another individual. And this was early. And he's taught me so darn much. And he, honesty. You know, if there's a crucial word in the program, for me, it's the word honesty. And that means honesty with oneself. And I says, Frank, well, how do you get honest? I've lived in this world of illusion and delusion for so long. I don't know when I'm honest and when I'm not. God, I told so many lies that they became reality. I used to, with a bottle and a dream, I could be anything. You know, I was an introvert, and when I couldn't do something, I could dream myself into it with a jug. Oh, Dorothy, no. I still am afraid to talk about my childhood because I lied to Dorothy so much. I used to tell her I was the greatest ice skater in the country. In Kansas, you know, I could play hockey and all that stuff. When I got sober, Dorothy said, let's go down to the skating rink and go skating. I said, fine, I'll show you how good I am. You know, we go down there and I couldn't even put on my skates. When I got them on, I couldn't stand up. And finally dawned on me that I didn't know how to skate. So this is a hard thing to do. And I said, Frank, how do you learn to be honest with yourself? He said, Cliff, like anything else, you practice it, and you practice it, and you practice it. And you continue the rest of your life. I've been practicing 27 years, and I still ain't honest. I can rationalize if I want to do something. If I want to go out and lose $50 or $25 playing poker, I know it's wrong, but I can rationalize. Well, I can afford it. I'm not spending that money for booze and all this. But anyway, he said, Cliff, kid your wife, kid others, but never kid yourself, particularly about your own drinking. You can literally kid yourself to death. He says, one thing I want you to do, go into that book and read it over and over again, particularly those chapters on alcoholism. Know the nature of what is wrong with you. This is the most complex sickness known to mankind. And he said, sure, you admit you're an alcoholic, but you don't really know what one is. Sure, you're in desperate, but get to know about the nature of what is wrong. And we have only one requirement to belong to AA, but I think it's a big one. This desire to quit drinking. I think, from my experience and observation, that before any alcoholic in the world ever gets permanently well, this desire to quit drinking must eventually equal his desire to survive. They must be one and the same. Else we will not continue to do the things necessary to keep us well, spiritually and morally and physically. But these things I began to learn, and I read the book constantly. I couldn't take the second and third step there. I wasn't capable. I asked Frank about it. I said, Frank, I know there's a power. I see it in you and Mort. And Gordon. I just can't take those two steps honestly. Second and third. You know, Clef, don't worry about it. Just try to forget the prejudice and your hatred and your antagonism of the past. Try to think what these things mean to you without prejudice. In the meantime, he says, use me and Mort as your greater power. And so I did that. Frank was really my greater power. And you know, Frank was a kind of a fearsome, awesome person to me. He had bulging eyes and thick glasses and a constant scowl on his face. He taught me another thing about love. That love demands, real love demands responsibility. It's more than an affection, it's more than a feeling. Love and responsibility go together like faith and works. One without the other is dead. And Frank loved me enough that he would make me hate him to keep me sober. And I've seen him take these super egotists and just tear them apart. And he'd come to me and he'd say, Clef, God, he says, this guy hates me. I really tore him apart. But then he'd say, Clef, I would rather he hates me and stays sober and loves me like a brother and stays drunk. Frank was a great sponsor, and I feel very grateful. But when I was the point when Frank told me to jump, I jumped. Salute, I would salute anything. He said, Clef, don't worry about the Godwins, the president, he says. Get into the action program. He says, you know, you got an awful dirty house. He says, I figure it would take about 50 years for you to even start getting that house clean. And the place to start is on the fourth step. Find out how dirty it is. And then he admonished me. He said, Clef, when you take one of these steps, take it to the best of your ability, whatever it is. Be painstakingly honest and thorough. Remember, you're dealing with the most important thing in the world, your own health, your own welfare. You're dealing with the business of living. So, being sure that I could never come to believe in God or have help on that source, I tried to do the steps twice as good as anybody else. When I took an inventory, boy, I took one. See, I think I wrote on every piece of paper in the house and the walls and everything else. Maybe it was when I took it probably to a ridiculous extreme, but I'm glad I did. One thing, when I, even though it might have been very inadequate, when I looked it over, you know something, I was quite surprised. I found out that there was a hell of a lot more wrong with me than just drinking. I didn't know I hated so many people. I hated institutions. I hated things that I never even knew about. And fears. My God, I didn't realize that I was just full of fear. It's been a part of my life for years. I was a moral coward. And I began to learn a great lesson. Not then, but I began to learn it. And it was, I'll pass it on to you. It's in the book, I think. You know, I used to blame my drinking on conditions around me. Oh, if I hadn't broke my leg when I was at Frosch in school, I wouldn't have lost my scholarship. I'd have gotten my education. And these young punks wouldn't have gone by me in business. If I had a boss that understood me, knew what a genius I was and how loyal I was. Or if we lived in a different environment. Dorothy got us to move out of this neighborhood. These guys here in the bar are laying me down on the floor and getting me drunk. Let's go to a different place. Just if the conditions were only different. I used to think, God, if somebody would die and leave me $1 million, I'd have no problem. I could pay off my bills and I'd have no reason to drink. But what I'm beginning to learn here is conditions are always pretty much the same. You know, ever since Adam and Eve, people have had to bury their dead. Everybody has bereavements, business failures, and disappointments. Tragedies? It's life. They don't go out and drink themselves to death because of it, do they? So what I'm learning now is that the program can change me to meet the conditions, whatever they might be. That I can stay sober, live to good purpose, and be reasonably happy under any and all conditions. That's the high aim that I'm reaching for. I called him up. I said, "Frank, I'm in trouble." He said, "What's the matter?" I said, "Well, I've been taking the eighth and ninth step, or you know, where you make amends." I said, "I've made a list of all the people I've harmed, and I've gone to them. So-so results. Really, I didn't have many. At least I didn't know it." And I said, but the book here says when you make your amends, you should go to your creditors and tell them what happened. And I says, "Frank, you know I can't do that. After all, when I took the milk truck to Phoenix, I took $800 of the milk company's money. The bonding company had to pay it back. Also, I borrowed $100 on a $50 Ford, which was wrecked. I owed the butcher, the grocer, I owed everybody in town." I said, "Frank, I think with such a weight of debt, I ought to go to South America and start all over." We have to know Frank, and I can still hear him say this. He said, "Cliff, go ahead, go ahead. But I want to tell you something. When you get there, at the end of the gangplank of that boat, the first guy you're going to run into is Cliff Walker. He says, you've been running away from that guy for years. Don't you think now it's about time you face up to him?" He said, "Cliff, when you come back from Phoenix, you said you'd do anything in the world to get well. Did you mean it?" I said, "Yes, Frank." He says, "Will you do what I ask you to do?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Get up tomorrow morning, go down to the bonding company, and tell them what happened." I said, "Frank, you mean I should go down there and tell them that I got drunk and spent all this money that they had to pay back?" He says, "Frank, they'll throw me in jail." I can still hear Frank say, "So what?" He said, "Cliff, do you want to live or you want to die?" I said, "Okay, Frank, I'll do it." Next morning, I get up, kiss Dorothy and the two boys fondly farewell. I go down to Spring Street. I make, I must have made about seven trips around the block to mean, I was an introvert and very timid soul anyway. This was the most painful thing I ever had to do. Finally, I got up my courage. I got up steam. And I go into the bonding company, and they show me into a room, and there's a guy sitting there, and I says, "My name is Cliff Walker, and I'm an alcoholic." He looked up at me kind of surprised. He said, "Well, that's too bad." I said, I worked for this company, and I got drunk, and I stole the money. I'm ready for jail. He kind of grinned then. And he said, he must have thought he had a real kook on his hand, but he had me sit down. He says, "You know, Mr. Walker, a lot of people get in trouble with bonding companies. Bought them for the same thing that you are here for." He pulled out a card and he says, "Here's a guy that's really in trouble with us. He owes us $45,000. And he says, "You know what the rate he is paying us all? We figure it'll take 980 years to get our money." He said, "Mr. Walker, if we put you in jail, we couldn't collect a dime from you. How much could you pay us a week in good faith?" Well, I named off all these debts, you know. I thought, boy, that'll get him. And I said, "Well, I am getting $18 a week Social Security. But I have a wife, a parakeet, and a cat, and a dog, and two boys to feed." He said, "Well, that's quite heavy." He said, "Could you pass 50 cents a week in good faith?" I said, "Well, sure, I can do that." He said, "Well, you pass that and we won't bother you." And he says, "If you can't pass some weeks, so I..." He just calls. But you know, when I got out into the hall, for the first time, I'm getting... this program's getting through to me. Before, I'm just taking it by rote, just like you'd take any bitter medicine. You didn't believe in it and understand it. You just hoped it worked. When I had gone in there, I was still defiant. I was sure that SOB was going to throw me in jail, but Frank says to do it, so I'll do it. This time, I thought, well, boy, maybe there's something to this. Being honest and face-to-face, off the oats box kind of stuff. Gee, that guy was great. Well, then I thought, well, maybe he was an exception. Some of the old cynicism came back. I thought, maybe I better try a few more before I go off half-cocked. Well, out on San Vicente and Melrose, near where we live, there was a Jewish grocer that I hated. I despised this man. Not because he was Jewish, but because I owed him $200 for groceries. And I couldn't pay it back. Now, he had never bothered me about it, but in my mind, I built up this terrible animosity towards him and resentment. But go something like this. Well, that guy, boy, I owe him this $200. He's going to run me out of town. He's going to put me in jail. Or he's going to garnish me my wages. And I wasn't even working. So I thought, boy, if it'll work with him, it'll work with anybody. So I dash out to San Vicente and Belrose, and still steamed up. And I finally get this Jewish grocer aside, and I says, "Mr. So-and-so, you probably don't know this, but I'm an alcoholic." He says, "You're telling me." Surprising how many people know. Anyway, I owe you a great deal of money, and I can't pay it back, but I want you to know I'm willing. Well, you know what that guy did? He put his arm on my shoulder and said, "Mr. Walker, I think you're wonderful. I think you're wonderful." He says, "You know, when most people owe me money and they can't pay, they move away or they evade me. But you come in here and you look me right smack in the eye and say you're a drunk. You can't pay. That's one of the finest things that ever's happened." Well, I broke down and I told him what we're trying to do. There's just a handful of us there in Los Angeles. We called ourselves Alcoholics Anonymous. We didn't know whether this would work, but it was our only chance for survival. And he was enthralled. When I started to leave, he called me back and he said, "Mr. Walker, don't worry about the money you owe me. You're going to have a tough road back. It's still depression." He said, "If you need more food to feed our kids, you come in here and get them from me. With me, your credit is unlimited." Well, I couldn't possibly describe how I felt when I got out on the sidewalk in front of that store. It's not describable, really. One thing I'd learned, one of the greatest lessons of my AA life, and that was how to master resentment. You know what the book says? Resentment kills more alcoholics than any other one thing. How I believe it. And that includes AA's. Resentment. And the harms people do us, whether they are imaginary or real, have the same power to destroy us. This Jewish grocer never harmed me, but in my mind, he had. If I hadn't gone there that day and made that amend, I wouldn't be here today. I'll be forever grateful to this Jewish grocer. Well, I went to all our creditors the same way. Took a long time to pay them off, but I'm grateful that we didn't get instantaneously successful. I can't stand prosperity near as well as I do adversity, as far as sobriety. But for another year, I guess, I developed this yin, or desire, to have a spiritual experience. The old book, you know, says, the original book says, after having had a spiritual experience, now it says spiritual awakening. And I thought, I see all these guys coming in there having these experiences. And I decided I'd like to have one. And I was always asking people about it. And I didn't want any mild one. I'd like one of these spectacular ones, like Bill. The room lighting up and the wind blowing through them and the lights flashing and nothing happening. But I got into a habit of taking the 10th and 11th step. At night, go into my room and sit there and meditate, try to pray, still feel like a hypocrite. My God, I only prayed because Frank says to pray. But I felt awful hypocritical. But I also would appraise myself and my day. And Frank had taught me, he says, "Cliff, you know, I was the kind, I was always worrying about my progress. I said, God, Frank, I still hate people. I still resent people. I don't like that SOB over there at all." And he said, "I don't make any difference. You don't have to like him. All you have to do is love him. Or love the son of a bitch like I do." Anyway, he said, "When you praise yourself, well, you always use two yardsticks. One he called normalcy and the other contrast." He says, "Normalcy, you praise yourself of what you ought to be, and that'll deflate you. Then when you get feeling sorry for yourself, use the contrast of what you used to be like, and that'll build you up again." So the thought struck me at this period, though I've been sober 2 years. That's quite remarkable. And not only that, I hadn't had a desire to drink for, well, I guess over a year. I hadn't even thought about it. I'd even quit dreaming about getting drunk. And occurred to me, too, that I'd changed. But the old fears had pretty well left me. I was a terrible moral coward. I used to almost dive under the bed when the bell would ring. Front bell would ring. And here, last Friday night, I'd even had enough courage to get up and read the 12 steps. Kathy, it took me 2 years to get up to read the 12 steps, so that's how fearful I was, and introvert. And I was handling things better. Dorothy and I and the kids were getting along, but everything was better. And I suddenly realized that I'd made a change that I couldn't have made myself. Sure, much of this psychology stuff was in Think and Grow Rich, and that hadn't changed me. But I knew I had changed to the point that I couldn't have done it. And all of a sudden, I realized that an intelligence greater than mine had been at work in my life. And all of a sudden, I came to believe. I think it was probably a merging of my own sensitive responsive conscience with God's conscience. Anyway, there was awareness that He had entered my life. It wasn't spectacular. I think William James called that the garden variety of spiritual awakening, slow growth and awakening. But whatever it was, I wouldn't change it for all the spectacular experiences of the world, because it was mine, earned out of my own hard-earned work and conviction and experience. So, this is what I was putting over to my newfound friend. Don't worry about the godliness. Not at all. I told him, I said, look, you've got all the requirements necessary to get sober on this program. You want to quit drinking. That you can be open-minded and honest and willing, you come to believe sometime. Just put this program to work at the level of your daily living, like the rest of us. And someday your whole life will change like ours. Something will happen to you and you'll come to believe. And this I've seen work hundreds and thousands of times over the years. This beautiful Sunday morning in Las Vegas, I'd like to tell you that in the last 25 years, since my spiritual awakening, that I had achieved quite a spiritual stature. I'd like to tell you that. It could be good storytelling, but it isn't true. My spiritual progress has been very slow and very plodding. At times, I think it's non-existent. In fact, sometimes I think I've only had enough spiritual nourishment to keep me sober. Because in trying to practice these principles in all my affairs, I sometimes can't quite be as tolerant at home as I am at the AA meeting. But I'm working on it. You know, I found out too that in these 27 years of continuous sobriety that in AA I can't work hard and achieve something and keep it. I can't bank sobriety. Because all these things are attitudes. I'd like to bank a lot of serenity. I can't do it. Happiness, serenity, peace of mind, they're all attitudes. You know, I have to earn the damn things every day. Sometimes several times a day. It's been slow, plodding. One thing I've learned, I never set up any second-rate goals for myself as far as spiritual progress. I've learned that from the experience of others. Because I know that self-satisfaction or complacency could stagnate me today and kill me tomorrow. So I know that even though my progress is plodding, it has to be that way. At least I'm growing. I feel that God put me and all living things on this earth to grow. And when any living thing stops growing, it begins to die, doesn't it? And I know if I stop growing, that I'll soon slide back into the darkness from which I came. So I've set up an impossible goal. My perfectionism has put up the goal of growing in the image and likeness of God as I understand Him. I couldn't possibly achieve it, but it keeps me working. As long as I'm working and trying to grow, I think I'll be okay. But it's been a wonderful 27 years. I wouldn't trade the worst 5 minutes of the last 25 years for the very best of my life before, believe me. I think to belonging to this wonderful society of Alcoholics Anonymous is the greatest privilege on earth. I was talking briefly at the panel yesterday at the Third Legacy meeting, the General Service meeting, and I told them that, and I'm sure they know it, that AA has achieved something. Just go off. Can you hear me? AA had achieved something that had never been achieved in the history of mankind. Can you hear me now? We have been permitted to achieve the old philosopher's dream of one world. It's never been done before. AA now spans the world in 90 foreign countries. We're even behind the Iron Curtain. 13,000 groups of alcoholics. In this AA world of ours, we have forsaken power, prestige, money. By better using the language of the heart, we have crossed over all the barriers of distance, of nationalities, of language barriers, of race, creed, color, social distinction. All these things that are so dividing our very troubled world today, we, through the language of the heart, have achieved this. And I feel very strongly if we AAs of today can always remember that this wonderful AA world of ours is God's gift and not any creation of ourselves. We have no special virtues or talents that made this possible. This is God's gift. This healing communication we have came from Him. And if we can remember that and always keep AA ever inclusive of people in need, if we can strengthen and broaden our lines of communication through our services, I think down through the corridors of time to come, we can make everlastingly sure that every alcoholic can have the same chance that you and I have had. Thank you.